Hey, welcome to the show. Before we get to my guest this week, check out my YouTube channel, youtube.com/PaulMercurio. We're posting new videos there every week. And you know we're all going to die. And dying tends to be, in our society, something that's maudlin and people avoid. But there's a whole other way to look at it. And my guest this week, Gary Latterman, has a really, really interesting take and a really interesting book on death and dying, and something that I thought was an interesting and always relevant and kind of refreshing way to look at a subject matter that a lot of people like to avoid. I think you're really going to enjoy this. He's a really, really bright guy with a really unique take on death, dying, life, and how looking at death and dying can actually, sort of enrich your life in a way. So enjoy that. Check out the YouTube channel. Thanks for checking out the show, everybody. Very excited to have my guest on today. Gary Latterman is a professor at Emory University is a historian as well as a religious scholar, and also has a great book out called Don't Think About Death, A Memoir on Mortality. Gary, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much. It's really great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So you wrote this book. It's it deals with death from a different angle, and it sort of really has two parts to it. It's personal in terms of your personal life experiences with death, but then also it focuses on some of your writings, scholarly writings on death. The title of the book is really funny to me because it's the way it came about. And you have a great story, I think, about your grandfather passing away. Not that that's great, but and how the title came about, and tell people about that.
Well, it's probably, my most vivid memory from those early years. It must have been 8 or 9. And I just remember clearly one night, just a lot of commotion after I'd gone to bed down our the hallway in our small little three-bedroom, one-bath house in the San Fernando Valley. All kinds of commotion. And so I looked out over the bunk bed into the hallway to see what was happening. And there were just what seemed like 20 or 30 firemen who were all crowded in the hallway. Of course, there weren't that many, a few, but
it just seemed like because you're a little kid.
It seemed like there was, some kind of, an incredible activity going on, but it was incredible activity. And soon enough, I saw them taking my grandfather, Zeta, out of the bathroom. He had just gone into the bath and had a heart attack and died. And so that's really a marker in my life. And looking back, it's obviously quite formative.
And when that happened, the rabbi spoke to you about that and said something to you that stuck with you.
Well, right. And that gets to the title, which is afterwards, our family rabbi came over, and there too, I just remember this conversation I had with him, again, in the backyard, a young child of 8 or 9. And he had me, I think I was alone. I may have been with my brother, but it was definitely just me and him kind of locked eye to eye. And so, he asked me, what I thought the meaning of death was, how I understood death. And of course, a heavy question, which I had no answer to.
Yeah, I would say so at that age. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Even though we all at various ages encounter and have to deal with that reality. But in any case, I don't remember what I said exactly, but I remember his words again very vividly. Him saying to me, "Well, don't think about death. Life is really for the living, and you've got to really do what you can to help your father who's grieving and your mother who's helping him." And so I that was really impressed on my mind, and I realized looking back again that I've totally failed in that advice from my rabbi when I was a young kid.
Do you think now, with all the wisdom you have and your focus in this area, and obviously the rabbi was well-intentioned, if you were he today in that moment, and there were a child at your age that just went through that, would you say that to him? I don't think you would. Why do you, was it just the era, the generation that looked at death that way? Because you have a theory, one of the overarching theories in this book and in your writings, is that we think Americans are death deniers, but you actually push against that theory.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to. It's a big motivating force in a lot of my work is to think against the grain of that particular narrative. And I think there's evidence to show that, in fact, we were simultaneously denying and obsessed with death. So that's a little bit of a different take on that.
What kind of evidence are you talking about there, for example?
Well, in my book, I talk about the Disney way of death and early Disney films in mid-century, and looking at those films, again, with my focus of research and realizing, those films actually are quite preoccupied with death or the fear of death or the threat of death of some kind. And so that's an example where, especially from the middle of the 20th century, which is often looked at as particularly death denying, in fact, you can find, again, this evidence in popular culture, in literature, in other kinds of arenas of American society where we're really actually quite preoccupied with the topic. As far as, the time period, I think, certainly the early 70s, there's a way in which generationally, as you mentioned, people, especially parents, would often not talk and speak directly about death, or at least for too long. And so, especially, I think, in the Jewish tradition, that, again, looking back, it was not a surprise that he would say that. And as you said, it wasn't ill-intentioned. It was actually trying to be soothing and helpful and get me going.
Yeah. There's an interesting quote of yours. There's a really great, people should look this up, a piece that you wrote on HuffPo in June of 2017 called Learning to Die. And in it, you say, once you take the plunge into the depths of your own consciousness and face your own mortality, you may never be the same, and America may be transformed into a much more humane and thoughtful place. And I found that utterly fascinating, particularly that last phrase and the connection to being more humane and thoughtful, particularly in 2020 and the world we've been living in the last 4 years in particular. Make that connection for me. And why do you think it's so important that people not just subconsciously or unconsciously sort of grapple with death, but really embrace it to their benefit?
Yeah, it's a tough one, and which is why it's a topic I like so much. I think it does have a taboo quality in terms of where do we have conversations where we can talk about it in some kind of if not neutral way, then just a kind of more direct, thoughtful way. Yeah. And I think that's partly why I wrote the book. And partly, I don't know what's a part, certainly a driver in my career is that the public reflection on death has some social value. And we're doing it all the time, often through religion or through science. But I'm an educator and a scholar, and I'm much more interested in what can I say? It's silly even to say, but a kind of more intellectual approach that still can be profound and deal with some of the obviously religious implications and meanings and practices associated with death.
Right, and you quote Jeff Tweedy. You say of Wilco. You say you have to learn in music. Is I think it's really cool. Is pop culture and music in particular is a big part of how you teach. And I know our mutual friend and my manager, Larry, who put us together, you guys have a weekly Zoom hang where you talk music. It just sounds really cool. But you quote Jeff Tweedy, Wilco, and you say, you have to learn to die if you want to be alive. And then you go on and say, reflections of one's own death can enhance life, bring greatest liberation, and allow true attainment of happiness. Again, like when, because I'm a product of the Western world, I think death, it's morbid, it's how, and then you have these words of happiness, liberation, and true attainment. Like, explain in your theory how embracing it can get you to a more enlightened place.
Right. Okay. Well, that not nicely ties into my other and more current research project, which is around religion and drugs.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you will see, I mean, if you just sort of read about the kinds of more scientific medical studies that are being done, particularly with psychedelics and then particularly with the psilocybin, you will find many of these studies will note that the people who underwent the therapy of the mushrooms and the psilocybin reported a loss of fear of death and reported that much of their, what you might refer to as their mystical experience, had to do with a kind of confrontation with death that was liberating, transformative, that completely, reoriented these individuals,
right.
Particularly in terms of how they relate to death. And we all have our ways of relating to death. So, again, that's in a more trippy psychedelic sense, but real nonetheless, I would say.
Yeah.
That's one sort of illustration of how, you know, a real confrontation and contemplation with death can really change your outlook and who you are and what you think this life is all about. Now, that's extreme. On the other hand, I'm just, you know, for example, in my classrooms when I teach death and dying, you know, I know how important it is for students to be in a space that isn't in grief, that isn't with their rabbi or priest, that isn't with their parents, where, you know, they can talk about, again, what we all are pretty much preoccupied at some conscious or unconscious level.
Yeah.
You know, my own mortality, how do I understand the meaning of death? How do I understand notions of the afterlife, identity, you know, all the stuff that is, you know, about what I study, which is religion and religious cultures, religious experience.
Well, you talk about like that you can learn, there are lessons to be learned in exploring this. By the way, why do you think your students are more comfortable in your setting vis-a-vis their rabbi, their priest, their parents? Because I would think that that's not something, a feeling you have to hide from somebody like your parents. But what is it that you think is liberating them in your space?
I'm always trying to figure that formula out so that I can market it or somehow make it more explicit. But it's something that maybe can't exactly be so quantified or identified. I think I have a good rapport with students.
Right.
I think the emphasis I really push, like, this is about analysis. This is about sort of intellectual study of history, of culture, of society. It's not about your personal feelings, you know, or how you felt when your pet died. So I try to keep the personal stuff out and their own religious views and background. You know, I mean, it's just, at least how I teach the classes, let's just immerse ourselves in the incredible diversity of attitudes toward death throughout history and around the globe. And you know, really, it's just to kind of shake them up in terms of what they think coming into the class. And then, you know, how their exposure to a lot of these things, you know, may in the end just bring them right back to where they started. But it also may bring them to a different
right.
headspace.
You know, you know, you talk about throughout history, you know, that there've been this focus on death, but it seems to be a universal attitude about death that's developed in the West. But you talk about Philippe Ariès and his four key attitudes from the Middle Ages to the 20th century about death. And there's tamed death, one's own death, thy death, and forbidden death. And right. it's a really interesting journey. And it seems like outside the West, there is a more deeply rooted connection to death or an interest in sort of exploring death or confronting death. And what does Philippe's work contribute to that? And why do you think that is?
He is known as really one of the, there aren't many historians of death, put it that way, but he's known as one of the best. And so, you know, he really did just the comprehensive historical analysis of him. And what I particularly like about him is he's just not only looking at religion and religious documents. He's looking at the broader swath of culture and, and looking at a variety of different kinds of cultural data. And he's able to really nicely package that and really capture these attitudes that I generally buy into in terms of how he sees, as you say, Western history, which is for the most part, really Christianity.
Right.
So he's looking at Christian, Western Christian culture for the most part, both, you know, in the Catholic form, early church, you know, up through Protestantism. And then, you know, in you know, he ends, he dies in the mid 20th century. So he was really writing at a time when there was a real sense in the West that death was taboo. You know, for him, that last attitude is forbidden death. Right. And it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Well, the tame death, which is acceptance and familiarity, you know, individuals forewarned when death was near were able to take steps to prepare for it. You know, that there's medieval stories of, and we seem to have gotten away from that, obviously, both, I think, you know, it's fair to say not just in the West, but why is that important to be able to prepare for that? Is it be able to kind of, you know, you hear stories of people, you know they have a terminal illness and they get together and they resolve their issues with their family and put their affairs in order, et cetera. But it sounds like more psychological and emotional than that. Is it because we're more of a modern society? And you talk about how it's tough to look at the morbid when we're a society fixated on youth and happiness and love. And do you think it's important to get back to being able to do a tamed death, if you will?
I doubt we'd ever be able to do it. We're just that's a kind of, I think, an attitude that's long gone in the sense, I think, that he wrote about it. On the other hand, you know, there are people who are super conscious of these realities, and that there are people in Western culture who reflect on death, you know, who, especially within different religious traditions, because I mean, to me, that's what religion does, you know, that's what religion is all about.
Right.
Kind of, right. You know, you prepare, get ready, right. And here's what's after, or something along those lines. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of what I try to talk about too is how traditional sources of authority have shifted in the more modern era. So we don't look so much to traditional forms of religion to answer our questions around death and dying. And we don't always look to religion to establish our values and our priorities and our morals in terms of how we live. A lot of that to me comes from popular culture. Again, in the, you know, talking mostly 20th into the 21st century.
Right.
So, you know, that, you know, I think that contributes to how we think about death in our lives. So people like just hear so much about near-death experiences. You just wouldn't believe how many students have told me about it, how many other people who,
really,
you know, when the topic comes up. Oh, yeah. And that, you know, in itself, although there are interesting historical roots to near-death experiences, I think that's an example of how a kind of popular culture can help us, reflect on and think about and prepare for death.
How so? In other words, just through film and music and other outlets?
In terms of near-death experiences, it's the message of the light, that there is life after death, that there is some kind of continuity, even though people come back. So that's, an example of how, in a sense, non-traditional form of religion is teaching us about death, even though these near-death experiences are very religious. But that came into consciousness for the most part through popular culture, through, a guy named Raymond Moody, his book, Life After Life, and then through various other channels. But religion hasn't disappeared, but there's, again, competing sources of authority around these big existential questions,
right,
that, as you were saying, sort of we all share.
Yeah.
Death.
And
sexuality, health and medicine, healing kind of stuff.
And do you find, you talk about, the experts, I'll call them, there were those in ancient Egypt, the Greco-Roman worlds, the shamans. Then you talk about the big one, God, Judeo-Christian, the expert of the experts, and you talk about modern times, which are doctors and funeral directors. And it's so interesting because I didn't think about it that way. But when there's a lot of this in reading the book and looking at your writings, like you go, oh yeah, like it's just beneath the surface. But yeah, I do that, or I do think that way. And it seems like you're saying in modern times, maybe we've moved away a bit from religion to the more secular, to be informed on death. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I think I like the compliments about my work. Yes. The shift is pretty radical and interesting, to these, maybe I'll come back to it, these two institutions,
right,
that become the, kind of foremost cultural authorities on death. The funeral home, the funeral industry, and hospitals.
Hmm.
And these are institutions that didn't exist in the 19th century, or certainly in the form that they do in the early 20th century.
Right.
Now, secular, no. I think religion is always with us. We're religious in all kinds of ways. So even if we're outside of the church, or we're not talking about a mosque, or Hindu temple, we will find traces and evidence of religious life, in places like the hospital, or certainly in places like the funeral home. There's a religious culture that is at work there, that is different than simply Protestantism. Or Judaism, or what have you.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I was raised Catholic, and my father died a number of years ago, and we had the traditional Italian Catholic funeral with the open casket, which I don't like. I didn't want to remember him looking that way. I never understand what is gained from that, one last look, I guess, but it's, it's just, it never, and it's also interesting, so then we had the wake, which is a little bit more somber. You go over to the house, you have some food and drink, whereas the Irish tend to sort of make it more of a true celebration of a person's life as opposed to the mourning of someone's death. So I do feel as a Catholic that put a lid on that death thing was kind of the vibe, right? Like, this is really bad.
Right.
And I thought about my own death, and particularly now, because I got COVID a few months ago and I've been dealing with a lot of those issues. And yeah, it's not fun. Wear a mask and stay away from people who don't wear a mask. That's how I got it. And yeah, it's not fun. And it's not anything like the flu. So if anybody tells you that, just turn away, slap them and then walk away. But you know, like I think about it and I think, you know, I would rather have people just celebrate what I was like when I was alive as opposed to this sort of institutional view of how you should look at death. But it doesn't seem to take on a larger, it doesn't seem to reach the masses. Why do you think the Catholics approach it that way, or some religions approach it that way?
That's part of the thrill, I think, of doing the class is when students really kind of see this really incredible spectrum of attitudes. I mean, not just that exist, you know, between these different religious traditions, Muslims, Buddhists, Christians, Jews, right. But then also within these traditions, the diversity within Buddhism, the diversity within Christianity, the diversity within Judaism. So it's hard to talk about why Catholics are this way or why Jews are that way and so on. Yeah. But I will say, just in terms of my own work and you're talking about, you know, embalming, you know, that's part of what spurred me on this historical pursuit is, okay. That's another story.
Yeah, yeah.
In the book.
Let's hear it.
That is really brief. I'm not much older.
We got nowhere to go. It's
okay. Right. We're just hanging. Yeah. That's great. I was a little bit older and probably I think in my teens, early teens, and my grandmother died, my mom's mom, and so again back. This time I remember though, earlier I didn't go to the funeral. For this one, I went and participated in the
funeral. You didn't go to your grandfather's funeral.
My grandfather's, right. When I was 8 or so. But now, you know, I was definitely with the family and we had a funeral service. And so to the story, this is coming out of, again, a sort of Reform Jewish household. A lot of people will say to me, well, Jews don't embalm, but Jews embalm, especially, I mean, Reformed Jews will embalm their dead. And so they might not display the body, but as I'll get to, you know, they, like everyone else in the 20th century, just about, embalm the dead.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, I'm at this funeral, we're behind the curtain before the funeral takes place. So it's just the immediate family with the casket. And the casket, you know, is open. And I look down, I see my grandmom, and it was instinct, but I immediately kissed her forehead. I just kissed her forehead.
Wow.
And saw her there, as weird as she looked, being embalmed. And so it felt right. Like the right thing to do, and at the moment, and then, a few minutes after, I realized I had all this makeup on my lips, and it was very strange. But that led me to the question, when I was a little older, where the hell did embalming come from?
Right.
You know, how did that get on the scene, and how, you know? And it seems like everyone's doing it, and that was really my first. That was my dissertation in my first book.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it rooted in Egypt and presenting the kings and queens at death to the people? Is it rooted in that, ancient Egypt?
Well, there's certainly, embalming can be found in different cultures, you know, in different different time periods and so right. on. But certainly the modern version of it, especially in America, is tied directly to the Civil War. Right? Civil War, pretty much before Civil War, no embalming and no funeral directors.
Yeah.
After the Civil War, you have embalming that becomes the bedrock of this new industry. It's built, you know, around funeral homes and funeral directors. So you know, the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln too was embalmed when he was taken on his little funeral tour. He was embalmed and put out on display, and you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people would go and see him. So that changed people's consciousness, and I think also people realized there's a business opportunity as well. And embalming then became the American way of death, as Jessica Mitford wrote. So that even Jews, Catholics, Protestants, Blacks, you know, just about everyone was following the funeral home embalming norm. And you do want to put them out on display so you have a chance to have a last look.
It's funny because it almost feels like you're breaking with society and doing something wrong if you don't embalm and display the body. Because I mean, there have been a couple of times where someone I know there has died, or a family member of a friend has died, and they, you know, cremated and just spread the ashes. And there was a reaction like, well, they didn't have an open casket? Like, they didn't have... And do you feel like there's almost societal pressure to do that these days?
I think it's, you know, it's breaking down quite dramatically these days. Certainly in the last few decades, the variation in modes of disposal has really exploded. You know, and that's coming not really on the heels, but following to some degree the most radical break from the dominance of the funeral home and the funeral industry, and that was cremation as an option. But now, you know, people feel, again, sort of different kinds of questions around institutional authority over what do we do with our own body. We're talking about a corpse or a living body. And there's a much more of a willingness, of an openness to experiment, you know, to, you know, have a green burial, to have, you know, some kind of cremation ceremony where you dispose of the ashes and so on. And I would just also just to follow up too, because I think this is a trend that tied into what you were mentioning, and that's, you know, just more and more funerals that are less like funerals and more like memorials, you know, where the body isn't so central in the funeral ceremonies, but what is sort of the personality of the deceased. And celebrating that. So you have, you know, there are more and more celebrations of life that are funeral ceremonies than actually kind of going to a funeral home, congregating around the body, seeing it go into the ground and so on.
What was it about the Civil War that made that the turning point? Like, what was it, because there was so much death and so many bodies sacrificed for a greater good that it was felt that there needed to be a greater ritual for these people?
I think, you know, in some sense, that's a part of it, for sure, but it's also very practical. And as I've, you know, tried to dig into this, it really is tied to pretty much wealthy northern families who wanted to get their fathers or sons who had died in a battle back from the battlefield to the local family cemetery. And so, you know, most of the battles in the Civil War took place in the South. You know, it's slow moving to try to transport corpses. And so people started, it's the American story, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit of how am I going to be able to help these northern families out and get paid for it in a way that's satisfactory. And so, again, arterial embalming as opposed to like putting corpses in caskets of whiskey to preserve them.
Really?
I mean, yeah, that was tried, but, you know, again, embalming and these new technologies of
seems
preservation.
Like a terrible waste of good whiskey.
How to do it. Yeah, go ahead.
Seems like a terrible waste of good whiskey.
Well, I mean, you know, what's going to preserve a body? And ice wasn't quite, fully there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you get, you know, the sense that that was a turning point, but also, again, tied into, you know, what does embalming represent? You turn a decomposing corpse into a, what looks like a simulation or some kind of artificial representation of a full person,
full
body that has integrity. And I think that absolutely translates into the consciousness in some ways of the body politic around the Civil War. You know, it's like, how do we make the dead symbolically powerful for the living?
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. It's very clear from your writing, from the book, and in fact, you say there is no one right way to respond and make sense of the end of life. There are a variety of ways people have confronted death throughout history. And it's, so to me, it's clear you want readers, your students, you want to open their expanse and let them arrive at their own conclusions, almost just like the Socratic method of teaching, to where they come down on death. Maybe they want to confront it, maybe they don't. But you seem, obviously, in your personal life, you've benefited from it. You say you can learn from death. There are lessons to learn from death, confronting death and from death. What would be an example of a lesson learned, either for you in your life, how has this journey of exploring death to such a great degree changed your life, made you a better person? I don't know. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I'm not that great a person. I still need to work on that.
That's not what
I know. I'm sorry. But man, no, I mean, look, I don't know. It's all a journey and I'm still figuring it out. But, for me, the lesson is the love and fulfillment of learning, you know, of just that expanse you were talking about.
Mm.
Like, you know, understanding how short our time is here.
Yeah.
And realizing how little I know.
Right.
That's kind of the first thing that comes to my mind is in my limited time here, I don't know. I feel driven to learn and to continue to learn. I'm a professor, whatever. When I'm in class, I'm learning from the students, you know. Oh, man, that's what it's all about. And I'm learning, you know. I love conversations like this. I dig banter and just kind of shooting the shit.
Yeah.
And as well as dealing with these, whatever, more substantive topics like religion and so on. So you know, I've come to see that in terms of my own reflections on how death has helped to sort of shape me and who I am.
Yeah, made you a more humane person than if you. Because going back to one of your overarching themes, which I think is sort of, it can actually create a more humane society. It makes you more sympathetic to your fellow man, knowing that we all have a limited amount of time on this planet.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, certainly. That's a part of it too. I wish it was the case, you know, especially now.
Yeah.
In the pandemic, or pandemics, if you want to talk about, you know, both COVID and the Black Lives Matter movements and the sort of social pandemic disease of racism and what that has translated into in terms of death and bodies in the last year. In fact, the book ends with this sort of afterword that looks at these two pandemics and tries to reflect. And again, it's coming back to, I'm sure this is a wishful thinking or something, but like the idea that maybe, as you were just saying, something we all share, it's universal. You know, we're here for such a short time. You know, we're going to be, the longer we live, the more we'll see and experience the death of loved ones and friends. And, you know, that can either close you off and make you more rigid, or more angry. I don't know. But my hope and what I've seen is it can also bring more compassion, you know, more sympathy and understanding for people who are suffering.
Yeah.
And a concern, you know, for the world around us, not just friends and family. But that may be wishful thinking, you know.
Well, you know,
death is the time. I don't know. As soon as I started getting serious about my education, I was like, well, why study anything else than death? It seems to be at the heart of it all.
Yeah.
And so turning that into some kind of public collective reflection is, to me, has some kind of, I just feels like it has some social value.
Oh, absolutely. It does. I mean, I think this is an important topic, and I think it's great that you have a body of work that really allows a person to explore this. But I wanted to mention COVID. And the issue that I have here is at the time we're talking, it's 260 million deaths, 260,000 deaths. And yet, I got COVID, and I got COVID specifically because a group of people were convinced by Trump that this thing wasn't real. It was a hoax. Wearing masks is their right. And what disappointed me was the lack of humanity in this COVID experience, both in terms of the living and the dead, right? Like, yeah, you have a right to do whatever you want to do. But my theory is if it destroys you and kills you and harms you, fine. But the minute other people are affected, you have a moral, ethical obligation to your fellow man to act like a decent human being. Add to that, that people are dying, a lot of them. And it doesn't seem to move the needle of compassion for a huge swath of people. Why is that? Is it because politics has taken such a hold that it clouds everything now?
Well, I don't know. It's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And it's certainly, my immediate reaction is probably like many, which is it's a total failure of leadership.
Yeah.
We are in that, you know, with that kind of number, we're talking about what I would label mass death.
Yeah.
You know, this is not like a sort of the flu every year we have these deaths. This is mass death in a short amount of time. Is incredible numbers. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just thinking about what's happened in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, as people have remarked, there's no effort at collective mourning. There's no effort at acknowledging in a very public, I don't know if anything can be non-political, but in a very public civic way to sort of address that reality.
Right.
And again, use it as a time, which again, this president is not interested in thinking about unity or some kind of, here we have all these deaths.
Yeah.
What are the bonds that, you know, unite us as to get close to what a great president once said, talking about the Civil War. But I mean, it's awful and disgusting, and I'm sure will lead to all kinds of forms of anger and in the long run.
Right.
The way some of these people have to die, which is disconnected from any loved ones, right? You hear that someone's in the ICU and none of the family members can come in, so it's the healthcare worker holding the hand of the person. Have you ever, in your research, your studies, and your writing, seen throughout history that kind of dying? And how has this kind of dying, both in terms of the way people are dying and the quantity of deaths, affected you or altered you in any way?
In terms of history, it's hard to think of other similar examples other than during other kinds of pandemics or during war.
Yeah.
You know, part of what I write about, part of what I've tried to focus on is that throughout history and in most cultures, there are ways in which the living can be intimate with the dead. There's intimacy, you know, you're close to the dead. You can touch them, or you can help prepare them for their disposal, or they're,
you mean, you know,
in most cultures, they're accessible and people are, you can be close to them.
You mean after the person has died or on their way to death,
like terminally?
After, well, both.
Okay.
I would say both, for sure. Right. For sure, both. And so all of that intimacy is gone. Now, I mean, so you can't get close, and you've got all of these concerns, and so you can't think about, you know, in-person funerals, or, you know, being attending the bedside of someone dying, and you know, all of that intimacy is just shot. You know, it's gone.
Yeah,
and so we are entering what I would say was, we were already entering to some degree, but now we're thrown into it in all this crazy chaos, and that's the virtual world. People are going to be religious like this online, and it's, you know, we're going to adjust and people will adapt and it won't be the same.
No,
but this is you know, in terms of taking care of the dead or thinking about, you know, the dying, there's no, at least for now, that kind of physical contact and closeness is lost.
Yeah.
What impact? I don't know, you know, the impact. I don't think any of us know. I think we all feel, as I will say, I feel, you know, it's like this deep existential dread. I'm fearful. I think, you know, death can strike and my sons, my wife, my dad. You know, it's just, it's a different awareness and consciousness of death that now more than ever we should be talking about and thinking together in public ways about, even as people are grieving and even as we're, you know, faced with these really just heartbreaking kinds of circumstances.
Yeah, it's hard to do that though when you have a leader that says it is what it is, you know?
I mean, this is what I mean.
You can't find someone who marginalized it any more severely or more than that. It's just so distressing. One of the other things you talk about is spiritual exercises. You talk about Buddhism, Buddhist meditations, and Christianity's focus on one's own death vis-a-vis in the light of Jesus. How important is the meditation aspect of it in terms of Christianity? Why do you think it's important why do you think Christianity thinks it's important to sort of look at it in the light of Jesus as opposed to bring it more home to just the person themselves?
Mm-hmm. That's a good theological question.
I got to write that down then.
Yeah, right. Yeah, definitely. But overgeneralizing, but certainly Christianity's perspective and understandings of death come through the life and death of Jesus.
Right.
And so, you know, same with the Buddhists, thinking about the Buddha and his experiences. Muhammad, you know, a lot of the main figures who initiate these new religions, different religions, have some kind of central experience with death that illuminates and also can be a source for teaching and bringing people together in some sense. So I mean, that too is just a kind of fundamental part of religious cultures for me, is, you know, how do they answer the question of death?
Right. Yeah. And sometimes I feel like, you know, the stories of Jesus' death, while they're impactful, if you hear it over and over again, and again, I'm not picking on Christianity or whatever, but, you know, that's my religion, but like, you hear it over and over again, you can tune out the story, right? And tough to relate to it because it is a story of thousands of years ago. And I feel sometimes, well, maybe it could sort of this, what you're doing with death, which is making it more personal and the exploration of its meaning more personal to the person and less esoteric, which I think I would categorize sort of the analysis of death through the life of Jesus or through Buddha. But I think religions obviously are set in their ways. I think it would be nice to sort of have more of what you're doing to the population, because I think it would be more relatable. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And certainly there are examples of other people who were trying to set up death salons. There are all kinds of groups that meet together that are focused on death. There is a fairly I don't know if thriving is the right word, but growing and very rich sort of death awareness movement that is here and there.
Yeah.
And Caitlin Doughty, I think her name is a well-known funeral director who's helped in a lot of ways to bring this topic into the public light. Yeah. She's got a group. It's called the Order of the Good Death. Mm. That is got all kinds of great, interesting things. And from her, even though whatever she's doing is great, she's a funeral director.
Right.
And so that too, is just what it is.
Yeah.
But it gets to sort of what you were talking about earlier, like the experts on death in our society are either the funeral directors or the doctors.
Mm.
So I'm a kind of out there as this liberal arts professor saying, there's other ways to think about, as you were just saying, how we reflect on death together that aren't so tied to those kinds of authorities.
Right. And allowing us to sort of chart our own path in terms of coming to some answers. Just to wrap up, there's something you wrote that I thought was really impactful. And you say, forget about Common Core, forget about STEM. If you want a real general education that's practical, relevant, begin your own intellectual and spiritual training in preparing to die, whether the help of religious culture, traditions, more pervasive influences like pop culture, like film or music. I thought that was a really great synopsis of next steps, and particularly what surprised me was the end, the pop culture, the film and the music, which we talked about earlier, because I know, other than, shoot 'em up movies or, movies where people die or movies of like someone dying of a terminal illness, I don't generally think of pop culture with death, but you've kind of opened my eyes, And I think you're saying that in sort of exploring it through music, listening to music, making music, for example, one can come to terms with it better, I guess, right?
I hope so.
Yeah.
And recognize that in a sense, you're not alone. That people, there are various ways the culture sort of shows us that part of the work of culture is figuring out how to integrate death into our lives.
Right.
And so music does that in ways that, again, you don't usually think about when you're listening to music. But if you take a course with me, I'm like, all right, look for the theme of death in music and the music you listen to. And then the students think I'm like a morbid nutcase. But then it's like, holy shit, it's like everywhere.
Yeah.
And even that, there's a kind of, I don't know, I think that sensitivity and awareness to how pervasive our interest in death is, again, and entertainment is a nice starting point to really try to articulate or express some ideas about what do I think of death and what is important about death for me in terms of how I live my life or think about purpose and all that.
Yeah. No, it's important. And especially now with COVID, people should be really reflecting on this. And it may not be something on the face of it that I think you're saying that is all that uplifting, but you can actually find yourself in a better place if you start to embrace it and make it less taboo. The book is Don't Think About Death. Your writings are everywhere. Professor at Emory University. It's really great to talk to you about this.
Paul, thank you so much. It's been great, great, great talking to you.
All right, there you go. Pick up the book, Gary Latterman. One thing we all got in common, we're all going to die. And he's got a really interesting way of looking at it that I think can help everybody. Anyway, hope you enjoyed it and got something out of it. And we'll see you next week, everybody.